I'm listening to the show every morning, and you can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though.
OTB's Mount Rushmore.
Some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GAA boys weren't happy, but it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
It's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the coach, because it's something, unfortunately, inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there.
Catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM on the OTB Podcast Network. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
All right, you are very welcome along to Off the Bull. It is another glorious May morning, which means we're watching The Last Dance, fresh from watching The Last Dance on Netflix. Every Monday it's here from 10 a.m. in Ireland. Off the Ball's Ronan Mullen, as ever, is with us. Kerry football and Tralee basketball legend Kieran Donaghy is with us. And a host of An Irishman Abroad, Jarlath Regan, is here. An Irishman Abroad Inside Basketball coming very soon indeed. Folks, you're very welcome. Ronan, you might start us off today. What did we learn in the last two episodes of The Last Dance?
Ooh, that's a broad question, Owen. I think a lot of people, just from my initial Twitter responses, that are picking these two as their favorite episodes.
Right.
And while there is a bit more of the same, where Michael Jordan just picking fights with random no-mark NBA players and destroying them in subsequent games, there's a bit of that. Obviously, the more grave topic of his father's passing, the impact that had on him career-wise. And as I touched on last week, this convergence of the two timelines, it almost hit a crescendo here, where there's very little difference between Jordan closing out, or the Jordan that came back to the NBA rather, and the Jordan that ultimately did retire from the Bulls the second time. So I think those are the two most interesting bits. I'm sure we'll get into the detail of it, but I'd say these probably are the two standout episodes in terms of what the amount of stuff that was packed in. That's my take on it anyway.
That's interesting. I think that there will be a philosophical divide on the last couple of episodes, and it depends what you want from your documentary, which you might get into in just a moment. But I might ask you the same question first of all, Kieran, as somebody who already had a wealth of knowledge about this subject, did you learn anything new? And I'm framing that question very carefully, because of course it was great to see new moments of emotion from Michael Jordan, but in terms of pure information, in terms of journalism, was there anything really new in these two episodes?
All right, look, I think you get probably not as much maybe as you'd want, but you're still getting insight into more the training session, into more the teammate that he was. You know, I think more explanation on it. We kind of know what the teammate he was at this stage, but I think you're getting insight from fellas who, like even Will Perdue, who said he was a jerk and that he was, you know, didn't like him. But when you now realise that he was a brilliant teammate and that he was driving them to get the best kind of out of himself. But you know, I think my favourite sequence of the whole show was in this one, just about, you know, about the way Jordan talks about himself at the end of episode 7, where he's kind of like, you know, they didn't endure what I had to endure when he had the injuries, when he was trying to get through the Pistons, when he was trying to get through all these guys, you know, and he kind of just says at the end, look, it is who I am, you know, it's my mentality, it's how I play the game, and if you'd want to play like that, you know, don't show up, because he knew what it took to get to the top, and he had the timeout. So I think he already had the recipe for success, and to see that was nice at the end of the episode 7, where you see the guys, you know, the way Steve Kerr showed up to him, and the way Jordan respected him more after, I think was pretty good as well. So I I love the two episodes. I love the way BJ Armstrong, he was going back at old teammates from the first three-peat season, which was something new, going back at Horace Grant, going back at BJ Armstrong. You got to see him go against his old teammates, and how, if any of them ever celebrated over the top by beating him, he always had the answers.
Well, let's get into this moment at the end of episode 7, then we'll come back to BJ Armstrong on that episode. The end of episode 7, Jarlath, Michael breaks down. He has definitely his greatest show of emotion, I think, at any point in The Last Dance. Like, of course, he is a very famous meme for crying in the first place. So it's not the first time we've seen Michael Jordan shed a tear. But it is interesting that this is the moment where we do see the raw emotion from Michael Jordan when he's talking about the demands he placed on his teammates.
Yeah, I mean, what was he crying about?
That's the question. That's,
my question was, why are you crying? Like, what? Why is he? What brought the emotion there? And the only thought I could have is that he is, he misses it. I mean, if you are someone who is that motivated, and as you say, there's a certain amount of repetition in the two episodes over exactly how driven he was, exactly how much he concocted slights to motivate himself, exactly how hard he worked, exactly how much his father meant, and how Jerry Krause was not someone that he was very fond of. He's gotta miss that competitive thing. And when he talks about those guys and how he got there, they really got that final question of whether victory and success on this level requires a sacrifice of the title of nice guy. And that is that. I thought that final sequence, as MJ montages go, was as good as it gets. And you know, I got the goosebumps when I watched it, and when his throat went and he said, "Let's take a break there," it was probably the culmination of all of what he's being asked to dredge back up, all of this stuff in terms of what's new. The biggest thing that was new for me was he had a master plan. He had a master plan in 1992 to play baseball. This wasn't, my dad died, do you know what I'm going to do to honor his memory? No. Before the Olympics, he knew, I'm going to shock the world. And I did not know that. I really didn't know that. And I probably think the newest element of information that I was dying for was exactly how much of a prick he was in practice. And probably they've skimmed the top of it. What were the worst names we heard were Fathead. There was a B word. There was a dumbass. And there was an MF.
That's terrible. Oh my God. How did Fathead survive that, Darla?
Yeah, I mean,
they'd want to mark some of the fullbacks I marked. They want to mark some of the fullbacks I marked. Because if they were calling me dumbass and all that stuff, I'd be delighted. It's far worse yeah. than that. But yeah, I think Jordan, you know, I think he knew. Like, I think him breaking down was also a part of him breaking down was the fact that, you know, and Kobe references it very late on in his career as well about like that he had to be the asshole as well, that he couldn't get the best out of him by being their best friend, that just the two don't really coincide. I think if they were all at a really high level and Jordan was playing on a, you know, maybe a Golden State Warriors with Durant and all these guys, and you've got four or five All-Stars on the one squad, I think he might be a bit more relaxed then because he knows everybody's so good. But I think he knew he had his cohort of guys. And Jordan was the main scorer. Pippen was the main facilitator. Rodman was the main rebounder. But they really needed to function. They really needed all of these guys, the Burrells, the Steve Kerrs, the Ku coaches. Jordan knew that they needed to be at the level. And him taking it easy on Tony Kukoc or Steve Kerr in a training session was just never going to cut the mustard. And he was right. Jordan was right. They'd go get eaten alive in a playoff game. They'd get eaten alive by somebody who is kind of... you know, I think Jordan, even Kerr said when Jordan was coming back from the first retirement, is that he was frothing at the mouth. You know, you that's what you face when you go into playoff basketball, like championship football or, you know, like Champions League in the soccer, whatever that pinnacle is. You know guys are going to be coming to take your life in essence, and take a victory off you, which, you know, which is probably everything you've dedicated yourself for months and months. So you have to be prepared for that. By having your mental toughness and your mental fortitude tested on a regular basis. And if that comes within training, and if that comes by Michael Jordan trash talking the shit out of Scott Burrell and all these other guys, to toughen them up, that when they face another guy from another team, that they'd say, geez, look, I've gone against Jordan in a training session. These fellas should be okay. And that's the way every top team functions. And, you know, I think Jordan, when he's breaking down there, and I think Kobe had a bit of it, is, I don't think they're just assholes because they're assholes. It was a part of an act, but it was a part of an act because they knew they had to do it to get the best out of them. That's what their mentality was. That's what Jordan grew up with. Grew up with his dad telling him he was no good because he couldn't do the stuff Larry did because Larry beat him in basketball. And Jordan's whole thing as a kid was trying to prove him wrong. So he wanted, I'd say, all these teammates to maybe look at Michael Jordan almost like he was James Jordan to Michael. They wanted to look at him.
Is that the only way you can lead a team, though, Kieran? That's the question. It's like Magic Johnson certainly didn't leave the game as people going, no, he was an awful man in training, but sure, we liked getting the lumps. Do you think that's the only way this group of lads could have been led?
I don't think it's the only way they could have been led, but within the circumstances they were, and with the media hype and how much every team wanted to beat him, Jordan couldn't have any of those guys. He's never going to sleepwalk into a game because he's just that competitive edge won't allow that. But when you start winning 20 games in a row and 14 games in a row and you're on this great season, 72-10, fellas start getting complacent. And if there's nobody in training barking at you like that to keep you on your toes, whether it's a manager, whether it's players, that's essential when teams are playing well. And even when we were in our pump with Kerry, like a guy like Declan Sullivan, I remember he had one line where he kind of said, look, lads, I have enough friends. I don't really want any more friends. I want good teammates. And good teammates are honest. You know, they tell it like it is. You mightn't like to hear it there and then, but I'm an honest leader and I'm going to tell you that way. And that's why Declan would have massive esteem with the Kerry team that he was on, because he was just that guy. He didn't, you know, if you'd want to be my friend, don't worry about it, but I'm going to challenge you and make sure that you know what it is to play for Kerry, and that when you put on the jersey that you know how you're supposed to represent it and what goes with it. And he had all the facets of the game. He had the leadership, the ball carrying ability, the score kicking ability. But he was our guy that kept us, you know, he was one of the guys that kept us on our toes. And
Did he have your phone number?
Yeah, he did, yeah. Now, phones were a bit more like, we can't go back and say, oh, Jordan didn't have Steve Kerr's phone number. That's a joke. These guys are fucking living in each other's pockets. They don't need each other's phone numbers. They're 82 games a season. I wouldn't have Declan Sullivan's phone number if I was playing 82 games a season and living with him 10 days at a time, weeks on end. So I think
so that didn't get to you at all, because I remember the whole Roy Keane thing about not having phone numbers. So when he said, I rang the Berto Centre and got Steve Kerr's number, I was like, that did kind of make me go, oh. Mm. You don't have Steve Kerr's number?
Yeah, no.
And he always refers to Scott Burrell as Scott Burrell. He never calls him Scott. I thought that was weird.
I wonder if the tears we saw at the end of episode 7 is guilt for Michael Jordan in a certain way. Did he want to have a closer relationship with some of these players? Does he now look back with the sort of nostalgia that would have made him weak in the 1990s, the sort of nostalgia that informs him that Steve Kerr should have been his friend or should be his friend, or that Scottie Pippen should be his friend, or that all these guys of that era should be his buddies, which is something he can think now when he's not a teammate of all of them. Like, it's not a winning mentality to think that way, but it's probably something at this removed where he's thinking to himself, God, I was a bit of a dick to all these guys, but I was a necessary dick and I needed to be for us to win 6 championships. I think it's just a welling up of grief and a welling up of the responsibility he had to
play. Do you really think that?
I do, and I don't think it's...
You think that Michael Jordan doesn't think friends come and go, championships are forever?
I 100% think Michael Jordan thought that in the 1990s, without question.
I think
right now, at this remove, when he's getting a little bit wistful, when he's talking about the memories, I just wonder if there was a little bit of that.
You think Michael Jordan thinks, I wish I got to go bowling more often.
That's not what I say. That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. I'm saying that I think that comes into his thinking at this remove. I think if he had to go back and change anything, he would not. Not for a second would he go back and change anything. But I think now, as a result of the way that he behaved, the necessary way that he behaved in order to win championships, the thing that you give to take back the championships is you sacrifice the close bond, the truly close bond and the friendships with these players, I think. I think as well, it was very telling. I think it's at the start of episode 8 when Michael Jordan is in the locker room after losing, the first game against, is the Hornets? Oh, I can't even remember the start of episode 8 at this point, even though it was only 2 hours ago when I watched it. And he's like, that's only one game. It's only one game. It doesn't matter. And there's almost a few kind of sniggers in the locker room with him, as if this is this incredible act that everybody is witnessing in the locker room, this insane level of competitiveness that people actually kind of look at with their tongue in their cheek, because they can never get to that level of insane competitiveness that Jordan is at. It is a level above everybody else. It is a stratospheric level of going to the to a whole new sphere above anybody else in the league at the time. And I just feel the price you have to pay, as you rightly say, guys, is that you can't get too close to these guys on a friendship level. But maybe down the line, when you're an old man with your cigar and your tequila and you've got ESPN around to your house, that might just tug at your heartstrings.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Owen. It's just his acceptance that it was a necessary evil. And once again, if he had to go back 22 years, he'd do it all the exact same way. But just kind of, it was a sliding doors moment in his life where it was like, yeah, I probably could have been nicer to those guys, but this is the way it was. And whereas I think that was sort of innate in Jordan, the Kobe Bryant one, because Kobe's my guy and I love Kobe Bryant, but like, he modeled himself. It was Michael Jordan by numbers. It was as if he got the Michael Jordan playbook and just ticked it off one by one and sort of
carved
this competitive spirit. And he had this very famous Facebook post that did the rounds. I think it went up in 2012. It did the rounds when he passed away, unfortunately. But he's sort of tying into that, you know, you can either be perceived as a villain or be perceived as a nice guy. It's hard to be a leader without sort of tying into the latter. So I think Kobe and they are analogous, but I thought Michael Jordan was sort of the precedent in his own way. And they are entwined, the thematic things of competitiveness with the opposition and leadership. But I'm so much more interested by the leadership side of it, because at a certain point, the competitiveness, right, is like, we get it, right? So the BJ Armstrong thing, it's like, poor BJ Armstrong had one good game and Michael Jordan had to trash him. Then LeBradford Smith, similarly. You know, this rookie comes in, has a decent game in a game which his team lost. The Bulls still won that game, and Michael Jordan was still sufficiently pissed off to go and rail him the following day. And then by the time it gets to George Karl in episode 8, where he walks past Jordan in a restaurant, and Jordan's like, "Oh, I'm going to stick it to his team tomorrow." It's like, right, okay, we get the message. But the leadership thing is the most interesting thing. And as I said all along, I would have been surprised, almost disappointed, if it turned out that Michael Jordan was just some chummy teammate that put his arm around everybody's shoulder. Like, that's just not the reality. Most top sports people are just like this.
No, it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of couple of instances that we've got in quite close quarters over the last couple of episodes of Michael Jordan getting trash talked to, and I put that in inverted commas, or somebody trying to say that they were as good as him and then sort of responding with a huge game. Like, it's almost like I've kind of typed it out here in like 6 or 7 bullet points, the formula of how Michael Jordan is taking down opponents in this documentary. So first of all, you get a talking head of any point guard in the league. Then you get a bit of a footage of the rivalry between Jordan and said point guard. Then Jordan says something along the lines of, he thought he was as good at free throws as me, or he's better at pitching coins than me, or something like that. Then it goes back to the point guard and he's like, yeah, I once scored 2 points for 400 attempts against Michael Jordan in the second game of a regular season game, or something totally insignificant. Then it cuts back to Jordan and he's like, that, the music builds, really pissed me off. Boom. Massive montage, explosion, pieces of Isaiah Thomas go flying. There's an iPad passed here and there. And that is an episode of The Last Dance. I can't even keep count of how many of these collection of instances that follow that exact formula we've seen over the past 2 episodes alone.
Yeah. No, the LeBradford Smith one in particular, where they kind of admit that that was totally made up. And I'd say that's one of dozens, if not hundreds, of fictitious gripes that Michael Jordan conjured up for himself. But I don't know. I just think the directorship was interesting. Like Charlotte mentioned, the bit where Michael Jordan says break, and even Jason Hare has taken a little bit of stick in the last couple of weeks. Like, that was a nice little thing to leave in. And the bit at the very start where Jerry Krause is having his press conference and someone accuses him of breaking up the Bulls, I think was the quote, or backstabbing, sorry. And Jerry Krause storms off, and they just leave in a little bit of a reporter saying, "Nice one, Craig."
He's going Craig.
So there's just little bits like that. And even
there's a Craig in everybody's life.
Yeah. And then at the end of episode 8 where Jordan's weeping on the ground with the ball in his hand after winning the championship. And you're like, that's the end of the episode. And then it cuts to the little bit with the Pacers where I think it's Reggie Miller goes, you know, "I'm gonna retire Michael Jordan," and that's the end of episode 8. So Jason Hare did a good job here. You know, he hasn't got the whole ballpark to play with. I'm sure Michael Jordan has put some strictures on him. But I think he's done a good job at what he's got.
I think he missed one big question. I thought that he dropped the ball in relation to Scottie Pippen and this stain on his career of quitting against the Knicks when the play's drawn up for Tony. We hear of Cartwright's speech, the tears. Scottie apologizes. And then we cut to Scotty's interview and he goes, but I have to go back. I'd probably do it all the same again. What?
Yeah.
Sorry, what? Why? Hang on. Well, hold. Stop the episode for a second. What do you mean you'd do it all the same again? It's the worst aspect of your career. It's the stain on your name. It's when I wear a Scottie Pippen jersey, people go, should have took the court. Should have threw the ball in. Just because you threw the ball to Tony doesn't mean that you're not the number one man on the court. Like, I thought Horace Grant's the MVP of that episode when he used the phrase Twilight Zone.
Mm.
When Scotty did that, and as Mike said, he'll never live this down. And to go back to him and go, I'd probably do it all the same again. What? I just was like, Jason, you have to ask why. Why would you do it all the same again? Your life has been irrevocably changed because of that decision, and you're going to stand over it? I mean,
it was a sulk, though, wasn't it? Wasn't it a sulk, though, more than anything else? Like the notion...
I think he thought Tony was going to miss it.
Kukoc is the guy that Tony Kukoc is the guy Pippen said wouldn't play in the NBA 2 years later, 2 years yeah. previously, and now all of a sudden he's taking the ball out of his hands.
That's what I mean. I think he was just pure. I think it was a pure sulk rather than him quitting. I think the narrative that he quit, quitting is when you're down four with a minute to go and you don't go back in. That's more quitting to me. This was 1.2 seconds. You're throwing it out of bounds. He just didn't take the floor. He sulked. He said, "I should be taking the shot, not him. I'm not going back out there." This was nothing to do with, oh, I don't want to go out and win the game for the Knicks or against the Knicks. This was a pure sulk. And I'd say
that's still quitting, though, Kieran.
Technically, yeah, but like it was more of a throw the ties out of the pram to me than quitting. That's honestly like you can afterwards, it looks
a
like
boxer
quitting.
Doesn't come out of his corner for the next round. That's quitting. Pip didn't come out of the corner.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, I've played with guys who I'm not going back out there. That's happened, of course. It's happened in the realms of it. I don't think it ever happened in a major, major game in a moment at that point that someone would take that stand, and especially for someone with his elk and his role in the team that year, you know, and that's it. That's it when you're the big dog. Maybe leadership at that level doesn't suit everybody, and maybe it didn't suit Scotty, and the pressure got too much, and all of a sudden, he was being second looked instead of Tony Kukoc, and he didn't like it, and he quit. Because it's good coaching by Phil Jackson. He's given his best passer the inbounds play.
Pete Myers, what a pass. Like, the shot is incredible. It doesn't even hit the rim. And the pass, though, by Pete, to throw and kind of lofts it. There's nothing is said about it. He lofts it. Pass. Oh. But like, I think, Kieran, if it happened in the Super League, there'd be shame around it. There'd be like, if that happened in Tralee, plays drawn up for Kieran rather than someone else.
Well, like, if it was an American, the guy would be sent home. If it was an Irish player and he did that, he'd probably just quit after it anyway. So it's, you know, I honestly think he was. I think he lost track of where he was. He was in such a rage that Phil chose Tony. Yeah. Some Eastern European who isn't that, mightn't be that, we don't know how great he is, but they should have known that, didn't they? But still, Scotty, in his head, he was the number one guy that Mike was gone. And now all of a sudden, there was a tiny bit of doubt into, Jesus, do they actually prefer Kukoc than me? Mm-hmm. And it was a ties out of the pram. I don't think he quit on the team. I think he threw his ties out of the pram. And as an effect, it may have resulted in him quitting on the team. But I think he was sitting there not going, you know, fuck you guys, I hope you guys lose, I'm quitting on you, go out there and beat New York, I'm not even going to play. Like, what happens if he misses the shot that goes to overtime?
Well, I think that's what Scotty thought was going to happen, and that's why I take your point about it's not entirely quitting, in that, like, really, the score was level, and as far as he could see, we weren't actually going to lose if I don't take the call. Maybe it was one of those calculations. But in defense of Scotty, and I do want to defend him, they did show what is the greatest dunk of all time, to my mind. That dunk over Ewing.
Oh, yeah.
It's the greatest posterization that has ever taken place because of so many reasons. Because of what happened in terms of not taking the court, because of the power and just the athleticism of going over a 7-footer, and taking him with him. Like, he took him on the right, right? He went up two more floors, brought him with him, walks over him, and then the afters. Like, I don't need to explain this to a lot of people who are listening already know why this is the best dunk ever. But for me, the walk over to Spike, says to Spike Lee, sit your arse down. I mean, it was like, I could watch that dunk all night. I would be happy with an episode about that dunk. But yeah, in defense of Scotty, he put the wheels back on and got back out there, didn't he?
It would have been very, very interesting if the Bulls had actually won that series against the New York Knicks, and how Scottie Pippen might be viewed with even more reverence than he already is. Like, I do find it interesting, though, that he does stand over the sulk. Like, it's one thing.
Yeah, that's
standing
that's
over the sulk, that is a long time. Just like a quick one on that season as well, which I found very interesting, was I can't remember who the exact quote was, but they said that the triangle was run to perfection without Michael Jordan there. It's only natural you take your talisman away from the team. You're going to depend way more on coaching and way more on what your actual plan is. I dare say that if there was to be a tactical breakdown of one season, that Chicago Bulls era without Michael Jordan would be way more fascinating on a tactical level than Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan.
I wouldn't agree with that, no.
I just mean as a case study.
I know it's a case study, but they still didn't win the championship. You know, they still won more games 2 years later when Jordan was out there running the same
I'm not saying it's more effective at all, or that it was a better... I'm talking as a pure exhibition of tactics. Without Michael Jordan, they had their shins on the triangle a lot more.
Yeah, of the triangle, that's the season you show. Scotty still averaged 22 points, 8.7 rebounds, 5.6 assists, 2.9 steals. Led the Lehman team in every category, but the triangle, like, it had to work to perfection, essentially. And, you know, again, in defense of Scotty, as they all kept saying, he was the arm around the shoulder captain of the team. And, you know, that nearly worked.
You still miss that, you know, and that shows you the difference between the two of them, like, is, you know, that triangle is great when it works and when it's breaking teams down, but when it doesn't work and things aren't working or breaking people down, that's where you threw the ball to Jordan and he was going to get you a basket. And, you know, as much as great coaching has and everything, it just shows you that great coaches always need the players. You look at any great coach, you see the players, which is why they obviously most of them end up winning championships. There's a huge collaboration there. You very randomly hear great coaches with very poor teams that don't win. And it was Phil, he's the guy who wrote his autobiography, said it was his best season as a coach, which goes to prove that his triangle offense is a great method with or without Michael Jordan. But to be the ultimate team and to be that team that wins three in a row back-to-back times, Jordan, it just shows you how much of a different level the guy is, because the way he delivers in the triangle and what he creates for others out of the triangle is better than everybody, probably bar Kobe. But those two certainly knew how to dissect it, as well as being able to take it over individually when needed.
It's interesting watching Jordan's comeback throughout this documentary. And one of the quotes that actually stuck out to me was that he was like when Muhammad Ali took a punch in the second half of his career, which is, I can't remember. I should keep track of these talking heads who said that about him when Jordan came back in one of his first return games, not obviously wearing number 23 at this point, which is obviously, that's off the mark, right? Like, did Michael Jordan have that vulnerability around him for the entirety of his second stint? I thought that was certainly just limited to perhaps that first half season that he came back into play and that quick playoffs run that they had. I certainly felt that there was an invincibility to Jordan again once you get to 97-98.
Yeah, I think that's all he was referring to, was that the Nick Anderson steal. I mean, it was the only proper Michael Jordan choke that is on record. I mean, they're one point up. I mean, he can barely keep the ball past halfway. It got knocked away from him on the inbounds and he loses track of his defender. I mean, it's rookie stuff. Like, you keep an eye on the guy marking you at all times, peripheral vision, you head up, you're able to dribble the ball well. And he is panicking, not only once, but twice. And that's why that game stands out in the memory as the first time Ali got rocked. And I think that's what that talking head refers to. It was it was him seeing, it was more like Foreman, I suppose, in the Rumble in the Jungle, the first time he sees stars and you go, oh shit, you can land a punch on Mike. I thought it was a great analogy because I can remember that day that that game took place. And there was a fella in my school who was a massive Magic fan. So you know the way there's always a fucking contrarian in your school who's like, I support Sheffield Wednesday. Well, that was this guy. And he was like, I'm an Orlando Magic fan and had been since the team was created for some unknown reason.
Yeah, he was for last year.
Yeah. So I remember him sidling up to me and going, just checked on Airtel. Airtel carrying the news that the Magic had beat the Bulls. And I was like, I don't buy it. It's just not possible. Because it was so impossible to perceive Jordan losing. If you think about it, he gets to the finals, you do not beat him. At that point, his return was a case of the jubilation that captured Chicago and basketball was, Ali's back. I mean, the rightful heir is going to return to the throne. And that was humiliating. You could see it in that timeout that his world's crumbling around him, and it becomes the motivation for what comes next.
Yeah, I love the way he tells your man in the gym, "Oh, let me know when you want me to see me during the summer." He's like, "I'll see you tomorrow morning."
Yeah, second Goosebumps moment.
Yeah,
how big
Tim
a factor?
Grover.
Sorry,
Grover nearly broke down in tears as well. That was the second tear duct moment. For some reason, his personal trainer is on the verge of tears. But physiologically, the transition from baseball to basketball shouldn't be underestimated. I'm sure it's a totally different ball game, no pun intended. Like it's a totally different body shape required here. And I'm sure the transferable skills of basketball and Gaelic games meant you could probably do the same training more or less for both sports. But this is a guy who was going from like short, sharp bursts to endurance and speed. You know, it's just total contrast. So it's no surprise that it took him a while, not to mention getting his touch back in that first season back, because it wasn't like that initial team when running the triangle with Pippen as number one on the team. It was grand, it was scoring by committee, and it was going fine. But then that season where Jordan came back, they were only okay. Like, they were about a 500 team, slightly above. So he wasn't coming into this smooth operation. And that's probably why things fell a little bit down. I actually think they probably overachieved that first season he came back. And as the lads have touched on, maybe falling short that year against a very good Magic team is what sparked things. But it also, I thought it was a precursor a little bit for just the way Horace Grant was let go, and that proved to be a determining factor in that series against the Magic. Like, Reinsdorf obviously looked at that situation. They're not comparable in terms of scale, but they got rid of Grant, brought Rodman in, and it worked perfectly. And they obviously thought when the time came to change the team around again in 98 that, oh, we just find the new personnel to replace Pippen and replace Jordan and replace Jackson. And it lulled them into a false sense of security, because Grant, though he was ultimately replaced, I think it kind of set the tone for where the Bulls' heads was at, and probably gave Jerry Krause this idea that, you know, I can wheel and deal here and get a new roster together.
Yeah, that.
I presume Reinsdorf and the coach saying that, you know, I knew he kind of, my idea of his whole baseball journey, because whatever about, like, Jarlath, we were getting the scores of the basketball games on Airtel, we definitely weren't getting scores of the White Sox or the Braves or whatever they were called, whatever their innings was. But my idea was that he struggled with the old baseball. He plucked away at it for a while. He hit a home run in the game. And in my image in my head is he kind of hit the home run, walked off, and never looked at the baseball bat again. You know, but it, you know, the fact that the coach and Jerry Reinsdorf are kind of saying, you know, he got over 200, you know, he'd 50 run out. If he actually played more,
if there wasn't a strike.
Yeah, if he got 1,500 hits, your man reckons he would have been able to play in the major leagues, which is astonishing. You know, the quality of these guys that make it to the major leagues is remarkable, and how a fella could pick up a bat for the first time in 14 or 15 years. And yeah, Ronan's right. Like, the body training for basketball would be completely different. Baseball, it's like the golf guys, what they practice, it's all core. You see every exercise they showed in the montage was core based nearly, you know. It was all, it has to be to be able to turn that, to get the shoulder strength, the hip turn, and to be able to hit the ball 400 yards, whatever these guys hit it. So fascinating to see a bit more in depth in that as well, you know. and it was nice. I don't think he was the teammate. I think he was the teammate that he would have been in the basketball if it wasn't such a if it didn't mean so much, if there wasn't so much riding it on all the time. I think there was so much riding, the pressure. Because you got to remember, if the Bulls lose big games, everybody's going to be like they did with LeBron James. They're going to look at LeBron James. Hey, LeBron, what happened? You couldn't get it over the line. You couldn't get these guys. What's going on? Jordan knew that was coming if his Bulls team didn't get over the line. If he didn't push Judd Bushler and Steve Kerr and all these guys. He knew that if they lost that big game, it was Jordan it was falling on. That's what the media would focus on. They'd bring up his gambling. They'd say, why is he not performing? So he needed these guys. But I think with the baseball, I think he was able just to have the crack and be a bit more enjoyable because the boys are probably all as good as him, if not better. But you saw his work rate was like he would want off a young rookie coming into a Bulls team or a guy, a first-year guy, a Luke Longley or a Steve Kerr. You're coming into this dressing room. We're successful. We're winning. I can't have you dragging your ass around the place. I'm going to need to demand that off of you. And I think he's talking about his blisters on his fingers from the baseball. He was up at 7:30 to bat in the morning. He, after batting practice, he'd do some more. So it showed you the way he carried himself. And we said this a few episodes. He carried that in the business world as well. He wouldn't wear the Reebok USA tracksuit. You know, he was all about Nike. He was all about the Jordan brand, getting it out there. And I think that's a huge difference from the way he was the baseball guy, which was the guy that was on the long bus journeys, the guy that was having the crack, having his few cigars, having his few cans with the boys in between games. Mm. And his body shape was completely different to what you'd need to be of a top-level NBA playoff player at that stage.
And yet, as you mentioned there, his work rate was off the charts when he was playing with the Barons. Like, it seems like a totally futile question to ask, given we've just watched a huge amount of footage on the impact of Michael Jordan's father and his death on his life. But like, what other reasons are there for one of the most competitive athletes in the world passing up the opportunity to go for four in a row twice? Like, the obvious answers are out there. Phil Jackson not getting renewed in Chicago, which we'll get to next week. His father's death this week. Is there any commonality in reasons beyond that Michael Jordan didn't want to go for number four? Is there just something about the three in a row that he really did feel his job was done? Even if you said it out loud, it just seems ridiculous that Jordan would not want to go and turn a three-peat into a four in a row.
Well, so I bring up this conversation a couple of times because it's the closest insight I have to the answer to that question. And that's with Roland Lazenby, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago, who wrote the biography, Michael Jordan, The Life, which is the partner book for this. And if people are looking for reading around this, it's his two books, Blood on the Horns and The Life. Those are the books. Maybe Sam Smith's Jordan Rules. But he said that when George Mumford, the sports psychologist, came to see the Bulls and see Jordan up close for the first time, it was post-retirement. And he watched him go as hard as we're seeing him go in training, refusing to lose any of the drills. Like, even in this episode, we could see they're running suicides and he's not going to lose a suicide run against anybody. And Mumford is impressed and he's like, yeah, he goes really hard. I can't wait to see what happens when he lets down. When does he release? When does this valve get let off? And he watched it and watched it and watched it and eventually came to the conclusion it doesn't. This is how hard he goes all the time. There's no breaks. And there, you say there's repetition in these episodes. I think that's to bring us to the understanding of he drives himself to break down twice. 93, yeah, 100%. 98. He's at the verge of a breakdown because no human can sustain that level of exertion without performance enhancing drugs, which he definitely wasn't taking. And the outcome was two early retirements. He just couldn't. And I think that's what our final two episodes are going to bring to light. You can say, wow, look at the drive, look at this. He motivated himself, he engineered all these things to keep going. But that straight line level of intensity, unsustainable. To walk away at the end of this, it has to be the exhaustion that they talked about and how close, I wonder, he came to breakdown. Because, Kieran, when you talk about him being a crack in the baseball, I mean, that's him drawing breath, clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about, he referenced it in episode one. I took a short vacation in baseball. That's how he sees it now, with a bit of dust settled. A little before going again, getting three.
He was more. he was killing two birds at one stone as well, because I think he was following on from his dad's wishes. So he had peace of mind up here. He was doing something that he loved doing. He had a completely new challenge. You know, people say he wasn't going to hit a ball, and, you know, all of a sudden he's out there hitting, and, you know, he's doing well, and the strike happens. And then he calls up BJ Armstrong and says, okay, BJ, what are you doing today? You know, we're doing, Mike, we're going to practice, so I might pop along. And as Jarlett says, that was him plugging out his iPhone at 100%. He was ready to go. He wanted more, and he wanted it now. And that first kind of 3 or 4 months was just that the body just wasn't ready for it. As soon as he met his coach the morning afterwards, the plan had been hatched to get his body back in basketball shape. He references about the shoulders, you know, that they were probably used to being in a hunched over position all the time. And he had to get a lot of stuff right in his body. And once he did that, he was able to, the energy was there to do it. But precisely agree with Jarlett on both counts, is that at the end of 93 and at the end of 98, this guy couldn't keep up that level of insatiable desire to win and to prove people wrong. He's making up stories to prove people wrong.
Yeah, making
it
up.
You know what I mean? That's how much the guy is driven, and, you know,
and also running out of reasons.
Oh, running! But he never ran out of reasons. George Carl passed him in a restaurant. He's like, "Fuck you, George Carl! I'm going to torture your team for the next 2 weeks."
I looked up LeBradford. LeBradford. I heard that story before.
LeBradford.
Yeah, yeah. Well, LeBradford is now the minority owner. Yeah, he's the minority owner of about 14 shops, and he lives in Kentucky. And he said that on the night of that game, that he had that great night. He said, I deliberately knew that if I said anything to the press, Mike was going to use it. So he said, I showered and changed quickly to get out of the building to avoid giving him any gas for the fire. It didn't matter. He was going to make it up anyway. I just think that's hilarious.
But yeah, like it is psychological exhaustion as much as physical exhaustion, just on those points you're making, that he was as amped up for a training practice or a game against the Clippers or whoever the bottom team was at the time as he was for game 7. You know what I mean? It's just he's always that amped up. And it would make you wonder how he'd get on now with pitch counts or the done thing and load management and the way Kawhi Leonard, who's, everyone loves Kawhi Leonard, but he can basically compartmentalize it and be like, right, I don't really care about the regular season, but once it gets to the postseason, I'm on. Jordan wasn't like that. He was the same in the regular season as he was in the postseason. But lads, I was just wondering, because I'm obviously watching this from something of a remove, but when that retirement happened, was it, how big of a shock was it, like, on the scale of 1 to 10? Because as we referenced last week, 92 was the apex. He was in the league for a long time, but it was off the back of the Dream Team where everyone in the world probably knew who Michael Jordan was. So when he steps away from the game at his peak, because my first sporting memory is actually Eric Cantona retiring. So I remember Eric Cantona retiring before I remember him doing anything. And obviously a huge profile figure with Manchester United, but not on a Michael Jordan level. But just the fact that shook the world of football. So I can only imagine what the greatest athlete stepping away from his sport in his prime must have done.
Fucking bewildering. Like, absolutely. I remember just being like, again, not possible, not true. And immediately the two dots being connected of his father dying and how that had affected him. But I still was like, what? Like the two, I think the retirement quickly followed by the baseball. I mean, it made absolutely no sense. I remember a teacher in my school coming up to me and asking me if I could make sense of it. Someone I didn't even know was following basketball, asking me, why is he doing this? Because as Coach Jackson says, you're robbing the world of, not to, you know, oversell this, but it's Michelangelo saying, I'm not going to finish the Sistine Chapel. I'm grand. I'm actually fine. And he robbed people of that. And I remember, like, not being sad about it, But just because I was so in love with the game, still am, but at the time I was falling in love with it. It was like a full-on kind of crush. It was all I thought about. You know that feeling, lads, when you're in love with sport at 13 years old. To have Lionel Messi or Ronaldo say, "I'm going to play tennis now," it's a bit of a fuck you. And I was a bit like, you're taking the piss now. Like, I remember a lot of lads were like, that's nonsense. Like, that's just nonsense. I mean, because we were a little bit further removed because of the lack of internet in Kildare at the time, you really couldn't get access to any kind of journalism on it. So all you were hearing were these little bits, and then this Sports Illustrated piece really maybe drives home that kind of bizarreness of it.
The Sports Illustrated piece taking down his baseball career, or the one when he finished his basketball. Yeah, that's interesting. Like, there's a separate conversation in Jordan and his relationship with the media, actually, isn't there? That he kind of says in this passage in episode 7, all you got to do is come talk to me instead of publishing this piece. Just come talk to me. Whereas in previous episodes, we see him being a tyrant in the huddle, controlling the narrative. People asking him questions about Scottie Pippen's future, and he's like, "I'm not going to talk about Scottie Pippen's future. I just want to talk about the game." And then another reporter's like, "So what about the game?" And he's like, "That's right." And you can kind of see the manipulation that he's got going on when it comes to the media that surrounded him at the time. That he knew how to play the game. He knew how the game worked. I would have loved to have seen his reaction if Sports Illustrated actually did come knocking on his door looking for a quote. I dare say,
of course they asked.
Forthcoming.
They had to have asked. He's saying that he didn't have access to Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated gave away Come Fly With Me as part of the subscription. It was the bonus gift. And you know, that was one of the things I imagine that would piss him off, was this is a magazine that sold millions of copies with his face on the cover. And now the first time he shows any signs of being human. And to me, that's the takeaway from the baseball thing, which is a totally separate subject. But the humanity of him trying and failing at a thing when he was so squeaky clean and spotless and unshakable is, in hindsight, kind of a good part of the story.
I thought so too.
Just the idea, though, that they would sell that many magazines and then sell them down the river when he first starts to struggle. I mean, even that picture on the cover, such a horrible picture of somebody missing a baseball.
They should know better too, because I whatever clips we got and tens of Roland's question, like you, I was just completely in shock. Cause as you said, we weren't getting anything, only the fact that he'd gone, no, he's playing baseball. So that's all we knew. We didn't have any other kind of real insight to why he was kind of stepping away from the game. But like the way his what I like the baseball part in this part of the series, because I love that vulnerable Jordan just trying to work so hard to get any type of joy out of it. I like, you're right. He's normally so squeaky clean. I loved seeing him having to work at that. But my point is, Sports Illustrated and the rest of the media should have known, because the press release that I heard, or that I heard most of, was, "I'm stepping away from the game of basketball." When you lose the love for something and you want the new start and whatever that sequence of lines was, he says something new and he goes, "I'm not going to say I'm going to close the door." Like, I never heard that part of the press conference really before. He says it in the press conference with Ryan Zarf and Phil Jackson. I'm not going to obviously fully close the door, which was a clear enough insight that what actually, when you look back and look at this now,
it was a break.
He was on a baseball vacation. He was taking a break from the game of basketball. He was probably always going to come back.
We were on a break.
Yeah, we were on a break. Sports Illustrated should have known that. It should have known that. But he's a bit like Alex Ferguson when it comes to the media. "I'll talk to you all day once you don't say anything bad about me." And
Sports Illustrated are the Rachel. and baseball is the girl from the copy store.
Lads, I want to get your...
The conspiracy that is addressed in the documentary, which I didn't think they'd go near, was the whole thing that actually David Stern had suspended Jordan for the gambling infractions, and this was like a quasi-suspension, basically asking him to step away. And the fact that Reinsdorf continued to pay Jordan that paltry, was it $3 million a year, contract while he was out playing baseball. So there that conspiracy is still alive and well. And Bill Simmons had a quote in his book of basketball, was it 12 years ago now, just around Allen Iverson, when Allen Iverson had that discipline problem with the album he released and had some unsavory lyrics in there. And basically there was a conversation to the effect that David Stern implied to Iverson, "You saw what I did with Jordan. Don't make me do the same to you." So like that smoke has been around for a long time, but they kind of dispelled it in this one. And my take on it is, like, it'd be too difficult a secret to keep, wouldn't it? Just the only people in the world that could know that would be Jordan and Stern, really.
I think your man's answer was the best. I can't remember which one, the talking heads, no, but he was kind of, he just said, "How can I put this, Joe? It's bullshit." And it is bullshit. It is bullshit. It had nothing to do with David Stern. David Stern even if John did commit the crime, David Stern, I think one of them say he's such a capitalist, like he's not, Jordan was just too big at that time to say, "Look, listen, go away for 18 months and we'll say you're quitting, you're going playing baseball." I fail to believe it. When you watch this documentary and you hear more of the teammates and you see more of the footage, you just see how wrecked he is at the end of 93 and 98. And Ronan's right. It's not just the physical torment of it. It's the mental anguish. It's being the bad guy at training all the time. It's driving fellas constantly. It's never taking a playoff, never taking a game off. I was looking at some stuff two nights ago there, just doing some research into, you know, around the Knicks and the Bulls series at that time, because I knew these episodes were coming. I wanted to see a bit of stuff in it. But to see where he's where what his ideas are, is strange at times to me, like, you know. But he has to do them things to get him to those angles, and he had to treat teammates like that. I fully believe he told himself all of that, that he had to be that guy and that he was okay with all that. And then you have the cranky moments where he punches Steve Kerr and he hits Will Perdue, and as we explained a few weeks ago on the pod, them things just happen in training. The fella's cranky, he's lost a few games, someone says boot him, and there's a bit of a dust up. But I like the way himself and Steve Kerr rectified that too in the end. And, you know, Steve said he'd more respect for me after that, and that, you know, Jordan and himself had a much better relationship after that. And it just shows you that them little moments can often bring a team together. And you often hear it about championship teams, is that famous day where we went at it in a training game, or there was a trial game here, or there was a trial game there. And you're brought to that level. And I really enjoyed Steve Kerr and Michael both telling that story back to back on each other.
And also you could see how one of those two men moisturizes and the other doesn't. Steve Kerr is a lesson in how much coaching ages a man, because he is like a prune, man.
There can't be too much stress coaching that Warriors team, for God's sake.
I know, you would think.
It's all
right?
From the last year.
But, maybe it was the HD, but Jesus, he is lined up.
Just on that Steve Kerr, Michael Jordan beef. Afterwards, Michael Jordan says, "I just beat up the littlest guy in the court. I felt this small." Now, Michael Jordan, again, calling bullshit on this week, and double standards on your dislike for beating up on people who are quite short. You had no problem on the psychological bullying, the systematic psychological bullying of your superior Jerry Krause, who was even shorter than Steve Kerr. Since when is height anything to do with the amount of respect that you should be showing to somebody? So in defense of Jerry Krause, I'm calling BS on that justification.
My takeaway from this pod in the last 4 weeks has been your love of Jerry Krause.
Jerry Krause is the man.
You've gone to bat for Jerry Krause big style. So I hope the last two episodes don't disappoint you, because I've heard some rumors that he doesn't cover himself in glory in 1998.
Once mentioned that Jerry Krause is dead, and I do want to be the one to raise that, given that I was responsible for that gaffe in episode one of this series, forgetting that he was dead. But I like it, you'd be forgiven for thinking it, watching it, because they no point do they reference, or when they put his face up, do they show the timeline of his life? You know, I don't get it that Kobe's the only person that they will reference as dying. I mean, another death they left out was Scottie's father died during that playoff run in, was it 1990? And a lot of people attributed that death, death of his father during the playoffs, with Scotty's migraine game, the amount of stuff that he was going through. But that doesn't get a reference either. There's some real, there's a few things that are really missing, along with that question of Scotty, of why would you do it the same way again? There's no exploration of Space Jam and the problems with the plot in Space Jam. how it was such a bizarre movie. There's no, they didn't ask Mike once about putting his shorts on backwards on March 19th in 1995. I mean,
could Mike put on his shorts.
Remember, there was proof of how scared everybody is of Michael Jordan. It's the fact that he put his shorts on backwards. Nobody could fucking say it to him for fear he boxed the head off them. That was an amazing moment for me that should have been referenced a bit more.
Could we have had 30 episodes of this?
Yeah.
I
think there's so much being just touched on, you know, just touching in this and touch. It feels slightly rushed to me that we got from, you know, where we did in the start of episode of 7 to 8. Like, you know, it's an awful lot scanned over. And
I really
think in hindsight, like, you know.
Focus on less, delve into the less backstories.
Correct. They're kind of hitting a lot of the stuff that we know, the competitive edge of Jordan. Like, you know, I know you're asking as journalists for any new stuff. Is really new, you know, the story's pretty well told. We're just looking for real confirmation from certain people that maybe have kept quiet in a lot of these issues, you know, i.e. David Stern, Michael Jordan. But, you know, it is, I just think there's so much left behind in this. I think there's
Jason Hare was initially asked, could he make the series with just the footage? So he was shown some of it. He was allowed view this, you know, apparent treasure trove, and asked, can you make the series just using that? Because as I've said on Instagram and Twitter in the past few days, I'd watch practices. Like, I would watch a whole practice. Like, that's how much of a nerd I am for this. That I'd be really interested to know what a practice looks like, and exactly how competitive they got to the point where he's, you know, screaming at people. But he said no. He said no. We, in order to explain the concept of The Last Dance and how we got to that point, we needed all those backstories. But I agree, the 72-10 season is potentially a documentary in and of itself. That is an unbelievable achievement. There's so many stories within that season, like a game in Toronto where they're down essentially 15 with a few minutes to play, and he just says, no, I'm not having this, and just finishes the game just by not passing to anybody else and just getting the win and getting off the court. Just as BJ said, he figured out how to win and manipulate the energy of the game to the point where he wasn't really playing basketball anymore. That 72-10 season, I thought it was criminal to whiz through that in the way they did. Like, that was their opus. That was the season, the pinnacle of this group was 72-10. And as he laughed at the Gary Payton interview, the glove never put a glove on him. I mean, he really didn't.
His heart wasn't even in that iPad scene. I felt there wasn't as much of the disdain that he had with the Isaiah Thomas situation. It was kind of more for comic effect. Lads, we're almost out of time. I just very quickly want to know what your final question is ahead of the last couple of episodes. What do you want to see covered? Charlotte, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I'll go first, definitely. Well, There's a few fashion questions that need to be answered on straight away. There's the double denim question of that pitch at that baseball game. Double denim outfit, full on, matching shirt and trousers. That needs to be asked. Is Jerry Krause, in fact, the American John Delaney? That needs to be asked as well. In terms of unanswered questions, I mean, we haven't had any discussion of the matchup with Stockton and Malone.
That's coming next.
That's coming, obviously, Utah and the Bulls. This next episode, and as it's been teed up, the Pacers are the ones. The Pacers are the ones that came the closest to knocking them. They brought them to a game 7, and this is a riveting series. Again, I'd watch a documentary just about that. I'm most interested in knowing the inner workings of that series and exactly how close they came to blowing it all.
Kieran, what are you looking forward to, or what do you want to have
I'm,
answered?
I'm You know what? I'm not too worried about what I want to have answered, because I want to look at the last 42 seconds of The Last Dance, of that game, against the Jazz. I really want to see Bulls player touched the ball for the last 45 seconds. They went from down three to winning the game. A guy that knew that this was the last time for this team. Could he do it again? I want to see the intricacies behind that. And I want to see the buzz that they had after that, because that was very much an us versus the organization type season. You know, it was very much as me filling the boys against Jerry, the two Jerrys and all them fuckers over there that want to get rid of us and don't want to pay us and want to fire people. So I can't wait to see the Reggie and the Pacers, because Reggie's brilliant on screen, and I can't wait to see some of the stuff around the Jazz and that final series. And you know, I watched back over that game. We watched it in the rewatchable. I watched it in preparation for our bit before the wrong game on one of the other gaffes of this series. But I watched how the Jazz used the same base to base screens or high post to low post screens to get a guy into the block. Normally Malone, how they ran it over and over and over again, and how Jordan knew with 42 seconds when his man went across the baseline that this is a load of bullshit. He's not going to come off up the up screen. They're giving it to Malone. How he knew to get it. He actually had patience when he went around to see the ball. I want to see all the details in behind them. And I thought one of the best signs of the day, I don't know, did you notice it in the 96 against the Sonics, the legalized Kemp sign. You see that?
There's also an Irish jersey in there. It has to be pointed out that an Irish man did appear.
Yeah, of course we got one. All we're missing now is a Kerry Group jersey. We'll have the whole thing fixed up then.
That's it. Plenty of time yet. Still 2 hours. Ronan, last word to you. What do you want to see?
Well, for a lot of people, Owen, surprisingly, it's going to be people want to find out if the Bulls actually won The Last Dance, because I got a spoiler alert tweet last week saying about Steve Kerr hitting the winning shot in 97, and people were like, what? I didn't know that. So apparently people don't know these things. But broadly speaking, is Jerry Reinsdorf going to get through 10 episodes totally unscathed? Because apparently he was absolutely faultless for the Bulls coming apart in 98.
Well, he's alive to give an interview, Ronan.
Huh?
He's alive to give an interview, so he gets a bit of an easier ride.
Keep an eye on that, though.
And then finally, is anyone going to beat Ron Harper to the best supporting character award that I invented a couple of weeks ago? Because he's been the best heat check so far. I thought Gary Payton was very good this week. Charles Barkley was very good last week, but Ron Harper's in pole position, and he has not appeared since
the fuck that bullshit line.
Let's see.
Line of the series. Lads, great stuff as always. A pleasure. We might do The Last Dance / Off the Bull Awards maybe next week at the end of the podcast as well, to try and crown awards.
If I could make a suggestion, I think we should split next week's episode. Yeah. We should have two episodes next week, one for each of the last two episodes. That's just my suggestion, but I'm biased.
Executive decision has been made. Let's do it. So double helping of Off the Bull coming your way next week. Tweet us. You can tweet Charlotte, Kieran, Ronan. Get in touch with us personally if you want. If you've got any shouts for any of the categories as well, or any of your thoughts at all on The Last Dance. Chat to you next week.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.